This is Mark Silverman, co-author of Rogue Mobster, the untold story of Mark Silverman and the New England Mafia. The story chronicles the mob wars of the 1990s when over two dozen gangsters were killed for control of the Boston underworld. When the infamous gangster James Whitey Bulger went on the limb in 1995, the streets of Boston became a war zone between the Mafia and the Renegades, with the Winter Hill Gang looking on. My account is the first ever glimpse into what went on at street level, why guys were killed, and what the stakes were. Rogue Mobster, the untold story of Mark Silverman and the New England Mafia, can be purchased online from Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and most other booksellers on the web.
Listening to Authors First on the Artist First World Radio Network, artistfirst.com. Tony Kaye in the studio. Thanks for joining us, everyone, worldwide. If you are an author, independent recorded artist, or looking for publicity, we'd love to hear from you. Simply follow the links we provide on our homepage, artistfirst.com. Be sure to invite your friends on social network sites, Facebook and so forth, to the broadcast. All the information on artistfirst.com, available free on demand. I'd like to thank famous personalities, artists from around the world for joining the broadcast. And this hour, it's our special privilege to have on board Shamim Sharif. She's an author, filmmaker. For your convenience, the link provided on our homepage, www.enlightenment-productions.com. Tony Kaye in the studio. Questions or comments, always welcome. Send them to dj@artistfirst.com. Let's give a warm welcome to our guest this hour, Shamim Sharif. How do you do?
Very well, Tony. Thank you. And how are you today?
Well, thank you for joining us in Great Britain.
Thank you. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a lot later for me, I think, than it is for you.
The technology is allowing us to do incredible things today that in the early 80s were only an imagination for science fiction. And here we are broadcasting worldwide in different continents, and those on their mobile devices, cell phones, automobiles, iPods are capable of listening to our every word. It's a great day for independent filmmakers and authors such as yourself to express your ideas, your concepts, and you've received accolades from many different sources on your materials. So audience, please visit the website Enlightenment, the little dash or hyphen, productions.com. And while you're listening to the broadcast on that mobile device or your computer, you'll be able to become more familiar with our guest, and feel free to send your questions directly to her from the contact link provided on her website. Shamim, this all began really for you as a writing experience. You're first and foremost an author.
Yes, I am. I always loved writing, and started out with short stories. Loved film as well. So actually the first full-length piece that I ever wrote was a screenplay, which was adapted from one of my short stories, which was published, I think, on the American Airlines magazine. And then I went from there to writing my first novel, The World Unseen, and continued. I was really lucky to be able to continue that process of being a novelist and also being a screenwriter and adapting novel into screenplay almost as I went along, because I really loved both media, I should say, and they, and I think they're complementary, but they're completely different. So it's not always an easy switch, but it's one that I really enjoy the challenge of.
In many ways, independent film and authorship was very much an isolated happening. If you were on a particular continent or country, you may never discover the work of a writer or a filmmaker simply because of the logistics involved. But the internet has changed everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for us in a really, really wonderful way. And I think in terms of the films, it's been interesting because I think we made our first two feature films called I Can't Think Straight and then The World Unseen, both based on my books. We were shooting them around 2007. And by the time they released in, I think, 2009, the landscape was really beginning to change tremendously. And I think when we had set out making them even just a couple of years before, there was a much more traditional view, even of independent films, that you had to find a sales agent who would get it out there on in cinemas and to DVD stores, that kind of thing. And by the time we released, excuse me, the internet made it possible to market movies like ours, which didn't have a huge marketing budget behind them, but which had small theatrical releases. It made it possible to market that online. And as a result, we had a tremendous following because there was a huge word of mouth on these movies and people seem to really love them and recommend them. And in fact, right now, to date, we have over 50 million hits on YouTube on the trailers and related marketing videos for the films. And fans have just produced literally thousands of their own videos using clips from the films and their own music. So it's been a really amazing experience from that point of view, to see how people responded and how they have the possibility to communicate across continents and across borders.
All right, YouTube, what were they looking for there?
YouTube?
Yes, under YouTube, the name of the film?
Okay, so if you were to YouTube and just go in there and search for I Can't Think Straight or The World Unseen, we have our own Enlightenment Productions channel on there as well. But it's amazing. I never cease to be surprised by, you know, there's always a list of new things that people have uploaded. I think it just seems to carry on the popularity. So it is amazing, and it's given it a longevity that a traditional distribution company wouldn't have had just because of the massive product that comes every week and every month. So, you know, for us, on the one hand, the illegal downloads have cost us an awful lot in terms of being able to sustain ourselves as filmmakers. It would have been lovely if everybody had bought a legal download or a DVD, but in the absence of that, it's also allowed people, particularly women, who watch our movies because of the strong, you know, the strong female characters and that sense of possibility, I think, that they have. There are a lot of women out there in Eastern countries who've really responded to the film who wouldn't perhaps have had the way to buy them. They often don't have credit cards, they don't have access to internet or to financial independence. So that's been really wonderful when you get emails from countries like that.
Shamim Sharif, our guest this hour on Authors First. Tony Kaye in the studio. Introduce the audience to your film, The House of Tomorrow.
Sure. The House of Tomorrow is our third movie and quite a different genesis and experience from The World Unseen and I Can't Think Straight, which are really, you know, traditional fiction feature films. One is a romantic comedy, one is a period drama set in South Africa. But with The House of Tomorrow, my life partner and business partner, Hanan, was doing something sort of philanthropic, I guess, in the sense that she is of Palestinian background. She met a very interesting Israeli lady, Liat Aronson, when they were attending a conference, and together they decided that they would put on their own conference under the TED format. I don't know if you're familiar with TED.com, but they have some amazing speakers and wonderful insights that these speakers have. And they decided to bring Palestinian and Israeli women together in Jerusalem, which was something that had never really been done before, and to try and sort of create some dialogue in a region which is famous much more for conflict. And they did that, and it was quite an amazing event. And you had Israeli women on the one side and Palestinian women on the other, entrepreneurs, educators, really interesting women who had nevertheless never come into contact with the other side, political side. but who got together and found all this common ground as women. And one of the major things they all wanted was not for their children to grow up in another generation of conflict. So a couple of weeks before we left for this conference, which I was also speaking at, and we had our children on holiday with us, two rambunctious little boys, Hanan turned to me and said, you know, I think we should make a film out of this. So, of course, I spent the next 2 weeks explaining to her why it was impossible, and it would be very hard to film, and permits, and
location,
going back and forth.
Location?
Right on location, and we were moving between Israel and Palestine, and there are a lot of checkpoints and a lot of security, and it's not an easy place to move around always. But we packed up our cameras, and off we went, and literally just shot it. Almost guerrilla style, I guess, as we went along. But it was just inspiring for me, I have to say. As much as I was worried about how the final product would turn out, just to get to interview some of these women and then to learn some of the stories behind that and just to get a sense of the history of this amazing region was just inspiring as a filmmaker.
How much time were you able to devote to this film? Was it a matter of months, a year?
I think it was... definitely months. I mean, the idea to do it was quick.
Right. Go in, capture what you need in the way of footage, and get out where you can finish the work.
Exactly. That was exactly it. And we literally shot, I would say, for no more than a week, maybe 10 days. We went back to get a couple of days more shoot. But the real work came after that, of course, not only in the editing, but we wanted to try and give a brief history of this conflict for people who've just, you know, after the last 60 years, I kind of got confused about what's going on and who said what and who did what, and to try and do that in a balanced way. And in that region, that's definitely not the easiest thing to do. So that was a lot of research, trying to get three impartial sources for every date, every event, every happening, and to try and really show it without any bias either way. So I think that was almost the biggest task, to break that into bite size and digestible pieces that were interesting, to put in the graphics and maps and things that would bring it alive, some really great historical footage. So that really took the most time, but I think it worked out really well, and we've had amazing feedback from it so far.
Did you have a scripted idea of the content you wanted to capture before arrival? In other words, had any of the outline of The House of Tomorrow been outlined previously to the filming?
A little bit. I hadn't outlined the history or the exact way the film was going to fit together. I knew that what I wanted to do was capture what was going on in that conference room for 120 people and be able to give a sense of that hope and that excitement and that sense of possibility to a much wider audience. So I knew that my core was going to be starting with asking the questions of the people who featured in the film, the interviewees and the attendees of the conference. And I had some set questions that I wanted to ask everybody just to get a sense of what their view was of the future, what their ideal would be. Because I think my core idea was that we do spend, and this was something that Hanan shares with me and she's so good at doing, is that we spend so much time thinking about what could have been, why things aren't the way they are, what could be different, but the more time that we actually spend with a vision of what we'd like to see, I think it makes it more of a possibility in your mind. And I think that's a philosophy that Hanan's always followed, whether she's trying to do the impossible and produce a movie out of nothing or whatever it might be that she turns her hand to, and it's something I've learned over the years from her. And I think there's immense power in that sense of possibility, giving yourself the freedom to think that, yes, anything could happen.
As an author, you have time to create the environment in which you want the reader to live in.
Mm-hmm.
As a filmmaker, how do you transition from that?
That's a good question. I think in The House of Tomorrow, it was really just trying to capture a sense of a place that's in constant flux and constantly dynamic and with so many clashing viewpoints. So that was almost easier in a way. We just kind of went in and went with the flow and to try and find things that would support the ideas that we had. With the other movies, like The World Unseen and I Can't Think Straight, it was really preparation. So that world that you create in your mind when you're sitting alone at a desk is a world that you recreate again with a team of people who are production designers or cinematographers or your composer, your editor, you're the people on set who are going to help you create that vision. So I think there is also that process of creation, but it's a much more collaborative effort. And I personally love that about directing. And it was one of the things that surprised me when I transitioned over to directing as well, was that you can have people who are better at all of their individual tasks than you are. So there's often a suggestion or an idea for a shot or an angle or a look or a feel that will surprise you or that you might not have had in mind when you wrote the book, but which is somehow better or better for film. So I think that was really an exhilarating experience for me, even working with actors in that sense, that sometimes something will come out of it that you could not have imagined, and that's when a really magical moment happens on film.
Shamim Sharif, your books, your films are very much an expression of your business. Enlightenmentproductions.com. Your materials are just that way. It brings you emotionally into a world perhaps you're not connected to, that suddenly you find you're empathizing with characters and situations you've never been exposed to. And that enlightenment enriches life and opens possibilities for people. Do you have that as an inner core mission when you undergo a book or a movie?
Yes, I do. And I have to say, when I first started out as a writer, I really didn't think I did. I was just intent on writing the stories that I wanted to write. But I think as you develop and you think about what it is that you're being almost driven to do, and I think very much so that's a core. And the enlightenment is in one way tongue-in-cheek, but in another way it's very much based on that idea of the age of reason and the age of possibility. And I think you hit it on the head there, because I think there is such possibility in the world. And what one of the beautiful things I think about art, whether it's music, whether it's movies or books, they make life worth living. They take us to places that we haven't been before, and yet that seem very familiar, because they're often dealing with conditions that we felt or that we've experienced. And when you feel with a character who's going through something that you have been through or that you can empathize with, and they handle it in a different way than you could have imagined, or the pressures they undergo are something that you can connect with, I think there's immense power in opening up vision and possibility for yourself in your own life without, you know, wanting to be too self-help or inspirational. It's not that at all. I think the core is an entertaining story. But what really makes those movies and books stay with us, I think, or certainly with me, are the ones that move us, that we remember for days and weeks after we saw them, and that have a subtle influence on the way we see the world.
So, your writing is elegant and with logic, capturing the imagination, bringing a reader into the material, well-written, excellent books. And the covers, the artwork that associate the book around them are equally compelling. When you're looking at the world unseen, you have two lovely ladies grasping hands in an automobile tearfully. Emotion, you have a gentleman standing rather seriously or on the hunt with a hat and tie and coat. And the scene there on the cover of The World Unseen draws you right in immediately. You know this is going to be a powerful book, as well as Despite the Falling Snow, which I'm holding in my hand. There's a continuity to your expression, that not just in what you write, but in your films, in your business, in your relationships. Mm-hmm. And that adds power and energy to the material. You must, I would imagine, feel like you're all involved with everything all the time.
Yes, we are. Sometimes it would be nice to switch off, but on the other hand, it is really a passion, and I think that's what probably comes through in everything that we do. And I think a lot of that is having started this process of working with Hanan, my partner, on everything, now going back about, I guess, 6 years ago, because she was always in brands, had her own businesses, and still does, in fact. She's also recently started an internet marketing company, Enlightenment Business Solutions, which is part of our group and which I work with her on. But
don't move away from the topic.
Okay.
Can you give us at least 5 or 6 minutes, please?
Yeah, sure. On that company. Okay. Well, what happened actually is because of the amazing success we had with social media and YouTube. People were asking us, how did you do that? How did you manage to get that level of attention for indie independent movies? And we looked at then sort of systemizing that, and we don't sit there and do the optimization and SEO and social media. We work with in a joint venture with a team who do that with us, but we're very clear on creating really solid systems and I think clarity in what we do. I think a lot of online marketing, internet marketing is often very tech driven. You might feel a little overwhelmed. Everything moves very fast. So I think it was our mission to come in and just kind of make it clear and say, well, there's an end objective to what you want to do. And Enlightenment Business Solutions is all about just trying to help you get to that and to grow other small and medium-sized businesses like ours, because I think that is tremendously empowering when you can control your own material, when you control your own products and services. It's not just within media.
You're so modest. Now, opening the broadcast, I think, what do we have, 50 million visitors? You're just off the map. You're doing a wonderful job. You've come up with, I think, a way of merging technology with the creative arts. That's where I'm driving. This company isn't about just search engine optimization. It's not about just making sure that your website looks fresh and you have all the underbodying words and symbols. It's a lot more than that. It's specialized in a particular area of interest.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the key, because what really gave us success was not particularly the way, as you say, we optimized our code or the way we designed our website. It was really the authenticity, I think. I think people sensed that we were genuine, that not only was that were the movies and books and the themes and ideas and the stories genuine, and you can gel with the characters and what they're going through, but also the people behind it, that it reflects genuinely our ethos and the way we try to live and the passion that we have for what we do and the way we feel. And I think that that somehow comes across, and there's almost something that you cannot replicate or cannot invent around that. And I think where that authenticity meets the new technology, amazing magical things can happen.
And I believe that is the real opportunity, growth opportunity for authors, independent filmmakers, exactly what you're talking about here, that I can take a small niche in my own community. 100,000 people live here. Mm-hmm. What is the percentage of whatever demographic or sexual orientation? And I can, if my product or service is niched to a particular area or of that demographic, then that demographic immediately through the internet is accessible to everyone on planet Earth.
Absolutely. I think we're going to have you come and do our marketing for us, Tony.
Well, I've been at this a long time right here at Artist First World Radio Network. Tony Kaye in the studio, and I'm so delighted to speak to intelligent, creative contributors to humanity, such as our guest this hour, Shamim Sharif. Thank you for being our guest, as so many others. You realize that a year ago, we had Davy Jones of the Monkees, mm-hmm, came on Artist First Radio, and he this year, 2012, had a heart attack and passed, and we miss him tremendously. But we've had millions of listeners to that show. And so his legacy, his artistic expression, and what he offered to the world continues through this medium, this file, this record of production that we're involved with right now. And
absolutely.
And you, as our listeners, are saying, wow, what a guest, what a show. And you're able to engage and go to Facebook and other social network sites and introduce a whole new audience to Shamim Sharif, to Artist First Radio, and to the content we make available free on demand from our website. Over 5,000 hours now, And I'm sure we've had over 25,000 guests. And by the time whoever listens to this 10 years from now, maybe it's 250,000. So here we are in a wonderful world. And you touched on the fact that you've lost some of the value in that people can steal, download your material, videos, books. And that is a unique problem.
It is. We're trying to like look at it as a, I think, as less of a problem and more of be a little more phlegmatic about it and say, well, you know, there's definitely an upside.
I meant ununique because what I mean is taking film to China and other countries and selling them. This is a black market. It's been going on for decades.
Yeah.
It's a big hole. And now that independent filmmakers and authors, you're just experiencing something that's been there for a very long time.
True enough. Absolutely true. There's no reason why now we can distribute, we get hit by that as well. But I think, you know, it's again, not the place that we want to focus on too much. And I think it's a process of education, and I think people are always willing once they realize. There's a sense, I think, with the Internet that everything should be free. But I think there are also an idea, which iTunes and music downloads in particular helped, that a lot of people would rather pay a little amount and get something that they know is supportive of the artist than not at all. And I think the other thing that you touched on there with Artist First Radio, what really excites me about that is that it also shows, I think, as our movies have shown and my books have shown, is that there is an audience there who you don't need to go to the quick bites, the lowest common denominator. And I think that's been really part of our quest to try and stay independent and true to the creative stories that we wanted to tell. And it's definitely been a worthwhile journey, and it's definitely found its niche, not only by demographic, by sexuality, by all of these things, but also by people who just want a good story, who want to be able to engage more deeply with a piece of art or with an interview or with a radio show, and to do that on a commercial-free basis and in some depth. I think there is quite a huge audience for that, and I think that's one of the wonderful things Artist First does as well.
Shamim Sharif, your books, your movies are very affordable, attractive, worthy of being read, recognized. You've received a number of international and local awards. Your material is just out of this world. Audience. It's good. It's really good stuff and reasonably priced. So please visit the website, enlightenment-productions.com. For your convenience, we have the link next to this interview. That makes it real easy. You just take the mouse and you highlight and you copy shortcut and you move it wherever you'd like it and post it. And now it's available free on demand all over the place. So have a good time with the programming. And thank you, Shamim Sharif, for sharing this time with us. Tony Kaye in the studio. If you know an author or independent recorded artist, invite them to follow the links we have on our homepage. We're always doing something new to help authors and independent recorded artists. Thanks for supporting the arts, all of you worldwide. Special thanks to our audience in Afghanistan, Iraq, those serving in the military. Thank you for making our programming and the interviews with our authors and recorded artists a priority in your life. We hope you're enjoying them while you lay there on that bunk and listen to the shows on your Android or mobile device. Now, back to our guest. The website has lots of content available there. You're beginning a blog, but before we get into any more business, I'd like to know, what's it like in a day in a life for you? When do you call evening done? When do you begin?
There's no typical day. So we start pretty early. We have two boys, Ethan and Luca, who are 13 and 9 now. So, you know, they're always popping up early, or at least the younger one is now.
Well, they're in school, right? I mean, that's schoolwork, homework.
Exactly.
That's bathing and cleaning behind the ears. That's getting off to their schedule. So your day begins very much involved in their young lives.
Definitely, and getting them out the door, and as you say, making sure they do clean in all the places they're supposed to clean, which doesn't often happen of their own accord. So, so we're all over them for that. We get them out the door, and then I can honestly say no 2 days are the same. It just really depends on if we if I am writing that day, I'll tend to stay home and try and focus there. Otherwise, we'll go into. We have a small office that we go into, and it could be a range of things from working on, you know, spreadsheets and not very exciting things to more of what we do on film development. So that process of making a film is obviously quite a short one, especially the shooting for all of our initial movies was no more than 30 days. And for The House of Tomorrow, it was 10 days. But the post-production takes a long time. The pre-production takes a long time. But it's really the year or two in between films that is pure development. So what that might mean is rewriting a script or writing a script to start with. It might be going out to meet various sales agents, potential investors, cinemas,
Shamim,
festivals.
May I interrupt, please?
Please.
All right, audience. It's Tony Kay here. No, you went right back to business. No, that's right. This is the second half, and I wanted to ask a couple little more intimate questions,
I
may. And if you're embarrassed, good. So you begin the day, you have a lovely family, you attend to their needs, they're off. Now you have a little time in your mind, in your life, maybe, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, of course, you're running businesses, so some of that itinerary is taken up by those demands at any moment. Is that it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's in between. So I'm very lucky that some days are like that, and some days are more quiet and just trying to get into that space where you can write. And I think Hemingway said you always want to leave something.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the day before, which is I think very good advice. And often for me that might be trying to get up early enough to go for a run in the morning, or just something that eases you into the day a little bit, that lets your subconscious think about what it is that character is doing, or, you know,
in running that time alone in your mind, you can clarify so many things.
Absolutely.
Maybe even come up with a new idea for the future. It sets
That's
you
right.
off. Or balance in the sense of, you know, getting in tune with what's happening in the world around you.
Absolutely. I think it's a very important time, because there's a sense in which you can't just run, and then sit down and pull out something that hits the core of anything. So I think that time of reflection, just assimilating what's been going on in the story and the mind and your day and your life. And when you're in that state, it is wonderful that almost anything you experience in your daily life becomes a reflection that could be used in your book. You begin to see the world a little bit differently. But that's the point when I, you know, sort of forget meal times and, you know, leave the kids at school. So then, at that point, it's very great to have a wonderful supportive partner who's always kind of very organized and got the iCal popping up all over the place. I can be definitely more of the drifter in the relationship.
And then when your day is done or you're ready to relax, perhaps with a glass of wine and just kick back and read some poetry, or what is the leisure before you can drift off to that sleepy world?
Definitely the glass of wine is a wonderful thing at the end of the day. Sometimes that glass of wine will be overwork, because what we try to do is pick up the kids from school and, you know, be around during that time, and that means that we're often catching up later in the evening. But, you know, we'll go to movies. I love going to the movies, and I think there's just something magical about sitting in a cinema with that big screen. It's one of my passions. So for me, doing that, reading.
Now, in film, are you interested in something totally out of field from what you're filming and writing about, or are you drawn to see what others, how others are expressing the same topic?
A bit of both, actually. I don't think it's necessarily a topic that I'm drawn to that would be the same, but I do like, if I am working on something like, when I've been writing Despite the Falling Snow, which as a film, which is it's a book currently, but it's set in Soviet Russia, and it's sort of an epic Dr. Zhivago-esque love story about two people who really shouldn't have fallen in love. One is spying on the other, a young woman spying on a young rising government star. So it's a very delicate story that only unfolds the true tragedy of what happened in the present day as you go back and forth. So it was, there was a lot of reference that I wanted to make, and I watched a number of movies that were not necessarily even set in Soviet times, but just love stories, spy stories, elements like that where it becomes about creating a moment, creating a relationship between two people that really shouldn't be. And that kind of thing is helpful. On the other hand, just going out to the movies is pure escapism. To go and see something like The Hunger Games is also a wonderful escape and a way to also stimulate different things. Because to me, a movie like that I just saw recently was not something that was high on my agenda. I didn't think of it as anything but a teenage novel. But in the end of the day, I was able to relate to it in the sense of how do you keep your humanity in a world that's insisting that you give it up.
Shamim, you very much enjoy historical or geographical context for the environment out of which your theme grows.
Mm-hmm.
South Africa, apartheid, a year, 59, Palestine, Israel, a locale, things that ground the reader or those watching the film into a setting that they can become immersed in themselves.
Absolutely. I think I look at these settings almost as another character in the story that we're writing, because or the film that we're making. And I think in the terms of The World Unseen, which was set in apartheid South Africa, that was close to home for me because my parents and grandparents are born in South Africa of Indian origin. And it literally frustrated me that my grandmother had so few choices in her life, but being part of a patriarchal Indian society and then further constrained by apartheid and the government. So I wanted to make a movie that would ask what it took for somebody like that to actually consider that they might have choices, that they might have possibilities, despite all of that constraint. And similarly, with Despite the Falling Snow, the elements of betrayal between two people, is it possible for there to be true love when you really feel quite differently about something as core as your political beliefs or your passions? And I wanted to explore that against the backdrop of ultimate stress for these two. You know, you're talking about communism versus capitalism, a spy for the Americans versus somebody who believes in the possibility of communism. So those kinds of pressures put onto people often bring out the most interesting facets of character, which is where the real drama occurs, I think, in any book or any movie. So I love those backdrops, and they're rich with detail. The detail that I found when I went to Russia to investigate for Despite the Falling Snow, to do some research, it was just beautiful to read about, to write about, and then to meet people who'd actually lived through that time, through Khrushchev's era, and how they felt about new Russia versus old Russia, the detail of how they lived, the way their tablecloths looked, all the nuances. And I love trying to recreate that in books and in films.
Yeah, and the fact that an audience can read and then go to the computer and type in the location or use their Google Earth and zoom mm-hmm. in, you know, you have to be accurate and credible as an author and filmmaker.
Absolutely.
That's a challenge if you're attempting to say the setting is one country, but you actually filmed it over there, as we would used to do frequently. We film in Mexico, but we would say, no, it was in Greece.
Yes, absolutely. There's still a lot of that. We actually went to Pinewood Studios yesterday in London because they were very kindly worked with us in our post-production for our other two films, and we're talking to them about this one. And it was quite incredible, the sets that they have recently been building of, you know, Chinese palaces and Moroccan souks and things, and all in the middle of, you know, the countryside in England. So it's quite amazing what does go on. But that authenticity is wonderful when it can happen. And with The House of Tomorrow, most recently, to be able to go straight into Israel, to go into Jerusalem, to Tel Aviv, to Bethlehem and Palestine, and just film these very visceral places, the textures, the colors, just the way the light comes in. I don't think that's easily recreatable.
Well, with technology.
I guess so. what am I talking about? I know recreatable because we did it in I Can't Think Straight. I think there is something special about, I guess, just knowing that you're filming on location. And we have that in The World Unseen, too, where the amazing landscapes that we have in the movie were genuine location, and those sunsets and sunrises. And definitely you can CGI those to death, but I guess there is something wonderful to know that you are actually looking through a 35mm camera at a real Cape Town sunset or at a real vista of the Dead Sea in Israel and Palestine.
You're operating your ventures, obviously, with limited resources. You don't have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest in a particular production. Those are unique challenges to recreate the imagery and the concepts of a big production as a small film.
Yes, and that, I think, has been, I give Hanan complete credit for that, because her view is just to say, well, what would you like to have in an ideal world, and then somehow attempt to make that happen. And in the first two movies, whether that was wanting to shoot on 35mm to, in this movie, really wanting to get a broad sense of Jerusalem, Israel, Palestine, and going through checkpoints that we perhaps shouldn't have been going through with cameras. But her view is that, as a producer, her job is not just to somehow finance things and make sure it happens and then sell the films. It's much more about the creative vision and facilitating that. And I think there is a wonderful tradition of that, even in Hollywood, but it's producers like Saul Zentz, Robert Fox, and Scott Rudin. And I think Hanan has that element on an independent scale. It's definitely a facilitating of the artistic process, and I think there is so much to be said for that. And we had some wonderful investors as well as executive producers who felt the same way. They wanted to support the films. The investment was almost secondary to saying, we've done well in business, let's give something back. And I think that's a really wonderful, wonderful form of philanthropy and a form of patronage, if you like, in the way that perhaps the Italian Renaissance used to have. And we're very appreciative of that.
Shamim, as an author, filmmaker, the war on terror, international terrorism, the use of airplanes as devices to murder people, bombs. Great Britain has a long history of that type of conflict with other nations, but worldwide now, this has become an alarming element. How has this affected your ability to travel and write internationally and film and record and feel comfortable bringing material back to Great Britain?
It hasn't been too much of an issue for us. I think, again, we just don't put too much focus on that. We just think about what it is we want to do. We know we're not doing anything that we shouldn't be. And it's just, I think in with The House of Tomorrow, it was a little more interesting because security is so sensitive in that region. So we had gone into Old Jerusalem to do some shooting, and, you know, they opened up the camera bags and confiscated one of our microphones. But, you know, we got in with the camera. It wasn't that there was a permit against filming or anything like that, but it's just there's peculiar sensitivities, and I think you just have to be aware of that when you are shooting. But of course, there's always the temptation to just want to get everything that you can possibly lay your hands on, because it is such a dynamic and amazing place to be. But I don't think we've had too much issue with that. but it's not a happy state of affairs, and it's something I also want to I'm thinking about for my next novel and film in progress is a little bit about how we face the world in a world where governments seem to have less and less power, less and less budgets, less and less money, and private individuals and private companies have a great impact or not on philanthropy, on the environment, on all of these things. And I think that would be an interesting subject to explore.
How do I know, or how do you know, when you're writing a screenplay, or is this a novel?
That's a very good question, too. So far, they've always been novels first. I think it's to do with the genre. I think it's to do with it. For me, I guess I just visualize it in one way or another. And with The World Unseen, very clearly a novel for me first. The same with Despite the Falling Snow. I just saw it in those terms. But I also write quite visually, I think, in the novel. So turning them into movies is not a stretch. I Can't Think Straight was a little bit of a different one. I had written a novel that was quite angst-ridden because it's loosely based on my story and Hanan's story. It was very hard to find actresses young and thin enough to play us, the attorney, but we managed.
I know, and the books are 341 pages to the page.
There you go.
This isn't a quick read of 200 pages. It's not a let's get it done quick romance.
Sure.
You allow time in 340 pages to really develop personality situations. Do you think that some of them may come back in future books?
Some of the situations, definitely. I'm always interested in situations where two characters who you might not expect to be thrown together teach each other something or influence each other to see something differently. So in The World Unseen, Miriam is, you know, going along quite contentedly, if not happily, as a housewife in 1950 South Africa, and without seeing any possibility of having a more equal relationship with a husband or more autonomy over her own days and what she does with them, until she meets Amina, who is a real rebel within that community, who runs a cafe, who doesn't have much respect for authority, but who's a very decent soul full of integrity. So I think that just, it gives Miriam the possibility again, the sense of possibility. So that kind of situation, I think, will recur in novels. And perhaps with some of these, like I Can't Think Straight, we've had such demand, as I say, with these YouTube hits and the overwhelming responses we get emails every day. So we are looking at doing I Can't Think Straight either as a TV or a web series, ideally, to give us complete creative control over that, pending some financing. Or somebody suggested that we look at it as a stage musical. So a friend of ours is actually the dean of the UCLA Film and Theater School. She's been trying to persuade us for 3 years to do this as a musical. So I'm a big fan of musicals, but I don't know if that's a possibility. But something could come out of it, I think.
Shamim Sharif, the character you most identify with in The World Unseen.
Well, I can't say both, can I?
Yes.
Okay, great. I think I identify more with Miriam, I have to say. When I was quite introverted growing up, and I think that sense of there's a place for everything, place for everybody, and you stick within it was very much ingrained in me, not in a particularly bad way, just in the sort of average way that I think so many people are brought up to feel. And
when did you overcome and feel I can express my true nature, who I really am?
I think I always felt that quietly. I don't think I was in any danger of being pummeled into anything that I didn't want to be. But having said that,
30?
I wasn't.
No, women never discuss their age. Was this a mature thing for you or early?
I will discuss my age. I'm 42 now. And I would say probably in my early 20s, I was a late bloomer. So I would say I was quietly writing. I knew that was what I loved to do, but I didn't want to announce to everybody that I was doing it until I sort of was ready to be, you know, sending things off to be published. And I think meeting Hanan was a big turning point for me. I had already started writing and had had a strong sense of who I was. But I think it's when you meet somebody who kind of speaks to those ethics and that,
yes,
those ideas in you, it really makes a huge difference.
It allows you the freedom to be what you want,
yes,
to be and think the way that you and express yourself.
Yes.
You know, if you're a poet and you're with a partner that despises poetry,
mm-hmm,
that's like, you know, misery.
It is misery, and there's a big,
you know,
hole where there should be something joined,
yes,
up.
Yes,
so.
And if you have two poets that love poetry, then now it's, yes, wow. I mean, it's now that you're identifying at every turn.
That's right. That's right. So I think we're a good balance. I'm very lucky. I get to be the more artistic, flirty one. She keeps everything going, and you know, we're very different people. Hannah is a great multitasker. She loves juggling a million things, whereas you know, I get very stressed if I'm not doing one thing at a time. So she would be liable to be doing this phone interview while emailing and filing mail.
She'll be next.
Goodness. I don't think so.
Tell us, we touched on it just briefly, you are working on two new projects. Any timeline for those releases?
Yes, for Despite the Falling Snow, we're trying to shoot by the winter, by December, January, which is something that you do when you make a feature film. You put this date and everything starts to move towards it. It's almost some kind of visualization and manifestation, because there's never a time in the feature film world where you turn around and somebody says, here's all the money that you need from 15 different sources and everything's going to work out. But somehow it does. So that's what we're pushing for. Things are moving along nicely with that project. I think we've got the script to a really good stage, and we're just going to start offering it to cast and to get a few more elements on board. So I'm hoping that works out by the end of the year. And I'm working on this new novel, stroke screenplay. Actually, I haven't decided which way it will go first, which is something to do with the themes that we discussed earlier about the soft power versus governmental power. But I wanted to do it in a fun action kind of way, so that you've got three female secret agents who are working for a private company, and I think while it could be a lot of fun, there's also a lot of interesting things to explore about how one feels about making big decisions that affect many lives and having the power to do that.
We look forward to so much great material, both in books and film. Congratulations on all of your endeavors. Be sure, audience, to visit the website enlightenment-productions.com and share the interview and, of course, the information if you're a small business person, which we all are today. You'll need to check out their website for search engine optimization. And as always, thank you, audience, for joining us. Very kind, everyone worldwide. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to, or closing remarks?
No, just to say thank you for everybody for listening, and I hope you enjoy looking at the site. I wanted to mention as well that we have an amazing singer-songwriter, Leonie Casanova, who has done some fabulous work in all of our films, and she even contributed the closing song to The House of Tomorrow.
She'll have to come on Artist First Radio.
I'm telling her she's going to have to do that, and we're hoping to also record her album later this year. And
when it's ready, bring her on board. We'll feature her material, play it in the rotation, and do an interview. It'll be a lot of fun.
We'd love that. Thank you so much.
Yes, Frank. Excellent. We love the creative arts. You just bring so many elements. Thank you for spending this time with us this hour.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me at Artist First again. Thank you.